Your audio doesn't sound quite as good as it usually does. Is that maybe just because Skype isn't using your mic?
Oh, you know what? That's because the mic is really far from my face. So all of that was literally unusable.
So your levels should have been bad. Were you even looking at the, were you saying level,
they,
levels, but not
they
looking
weren't
at the
great.
Levels?
No, they weren't great.
And you're like, you know they what? That wasn't great. Good. I'm going like, to do nothing about it.
Probably fine. Do I sound better now? Fun fact. Charles Schulz didn't choose the name Peanuts for his comic strip. It was chosen by the syndicate, and he hated it.
I've heard about this recently.
And, yeah, from me, because this was on our Lost episode, and it's back.
And it's back, the Lost episode that Alan didn't record.
Yeah, so I just love this fact, so I thought I would tell you about it again, because I doubt you remember all the details.
I was really glad to learn this, because... Yeah. Peanuts is a terrible name. Why is it called Peanuts?
Yeah. Well, so why is it called Peanuts? Because I stumbled into this fact. This was a backdoor fact.
Okay.
I was trying to determine why we use the term peanut gallery.
Right. Which is problematic, and question mark?
Not problematic. Yeah. I mean, not really, not directly problematic. I guess classist.
Well,
but so the term comes from vaudeville. Mm-hmm. So if I guess that
a lot of problematic.
Yeah. So far we're still in the problem zone, and was used to refer to the cheapest and rowdiest seats where the occupants were the most likely to heckle the performers. Mm-hmm. And that is because the cheapest snacks sold at the theater would often be peanuts. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't like the show, they would throw their peanuts at the performers, which is what led to phrases like "no comment" from the peanut gallery, meaning "don't throw anything at me."
Right.
You people sitting in the cheapest seats.
Boors.
You uncultured boors who don't understand how incredible this entertainment is that you're currently being performed at by.
Uh-huh. Speaking of which, aside.
Yeah.
Recently learned that there's a tendency in language that things that describe a median person or just a typical person slowly come to mean negative, because upper classes would talk about median people as if they were unethical and suddenly or whatever. So like a villain was just like someone in the village, just like, you know, a person. And then slowly, eventually they were so low.
That's a dramatic version of that. Yeah.
Now, you know, and there's various other examples of this. And that came up because someone was talking about how the term mid, which is like a current recent slang term that somebody would use to be like, oh, I think, you know, Succession was a great show. And somebody would say, oh, yeah, it was
mid.
But slowly it's becoming mid is not medium. Mid means... Yeah, it's not
terrible.
Great. It's kind of bad. It's like mediocre.
Yeah.
Mediocre.
I want everyone out there to know that Alan Pike thinks that Succession was a bad show.
Succession was great. But I'm just saying someone out there might respond
someone
to my...
Might. Not you. I never saw it. So in the 40s, there was a popular children's radio show. And I think it became a television show later called Howdy Doody.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
Which is a very funny name for a show.
The children's show seems kind of tracks.
Yeah, and so they used the name Peanut Gallery for their live audience of children.
Okay.
They referred to them as peanuts.
Right.
I guess because they were rowdy.
Or maybe because they were little.
Yeah, oh, maybe also. So anyway, simultaneously in the 40s.
Like when you think of a peanut, what do you think of? Is it little or rowdy? You're just... Like,
well,
no, but
it comes from Peanut Gallery, so that's where I was getting the rowdy from.
Oh, okay, so the Peanut Gallery term had already been referred. I see.
Yeah, the Peanut Gallery term was older than that.
Okay.
Long before the 40s. Uh-huh. So simultaneously, contemporaneously, more or less, there was a new comic strip called Peanuts, and that we're talking about here, the one that we all know and love. But it started out in 1947 and was originally only in one paper. It was in the St. Paul Pioneer Press.
But it was called Peanuts.
In Minnesota. And it was not called Peanuts. It was called Lil Folks. L-I-apostrophe-L Folks. Folks.
Right.
And when Charles Schulz, the creator of what we know now as Peanuts, Lil Folks creator Charles Schulz, submitted it to the United Features Syndicate, which is like the big syndicate. So adorable that they call themselves a syndicate, but the big syndicate that controls like comic strips.
It's like their shady organization of comic authors that.
Yeah, exactly. They did some, you know, a trademark research or whatever, and discovered that there was a retired 1930s newspaper strip called Little Folks with no apostrophe, L-I-T-T-L-E, Little Folks. And the author, who had the adorably 30s and 40s name of Tack Knight, first name Tack,
definitely not really made a name. Up. I feel like you could be a news anchor.
It's a very newsman name.
The News Hour with Tack Knight.
With Tack Knight, exactly. He claimed that he had a trademark over the title. I don't know why he claimed it. I don't know if he did or didn't. But at any rate, the production manager at United Feature Syndicate knew that Howdy Doody was popular and that kids were referred to as peanuts on the show and thought, oh, I've got this new strip. I'll just call it that. And then it'll be a brand synergy or whatever. But like I said, Charles Schulz hated it. Now, his primary objection, which makes a lot of sense to me, was that there's no character in the strip called Peanuts.
I mean, yeah. I mean, there's no character called Lil Folk either, but
yeah, but there are little folks in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the day that the first one came out in the paper, he, a friend of his, you know, like went to the newsstand in Minneapolis to like get a copy of it and asked, hey, do you have any papers that carry Peanuts? And was told no, and that there were also none that carried popcorn. And he told Schulz that story. It just made Schulz even madder about it. He's like, I knew it was a bad name. Right. So for the rest of his life, when anyone asked him, like, well, you know, what do you do for a living? You know, he would say, I draw that comic strip with Snoopy in it, Charlie Brown and his dog.
Which is what I would call it, too.
Yeah. And I, you know, I, but what I find funniest about that, too, is that nowadays, I mean, Snoopy's the only thing my kids know about it. That's the show that's on, like, Apple TV Plus.
Is it good? I haven't seen it.
It is good. It's great. Yeah. And although my kids call him Snoofy.
Which is an improvement.
Yeah. I have a Snoofy watch they always make me wear.
Nice.
But, yeah, no, it is good. It's quite a good show. So, yeah, I fun fact, it's only fun for really you. I am a huge Peanuts fan. And especially the old ones, like they're very dark and depressing. That comic strip from like the 60s, like he went through like a really,
she kept moving that football.
She
would let his hopes get up.
She was just so good at convincing him that this time would be the time.
I can see how that would really get you feels.
Yeah. No, there's some like amazing, it's a very quality strip, but yeah. Really weird name, doesn't make any sense, and now you know why. And now you know the rest of the story with Tack Knight.
I do appreciate that it was known to be bad by the creator.
Knew it was bad, yeah. He didn't think it was good.
I do, that does give me a little bit of, I don't want to say anxiety, but this idea that you can go and create something, like you hear about book authors that are like, they put all this blood and sweat and tears into writing a book, and you don't have control as the author over like the cover, and they're just like, they put some horrible graphic on there or something.
Yeah, you got nothing. You got to hope. I mean, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien. So Lord of the Rings was originally one book, and it was too big to be published, and so they split it into three books. And he famously did not choose or like the titles of the books because, to his mind, especially the third one, gave away the ending.
Right. I wonder if the king's going to return or not. Unclear. Yeah. Let's find out.
This doesn't seem like a great title, guys.
Yeah.
But
why they called the third Star Wars film Darth Vader Turns to the Light Side at the end.
Well, I mean, honestly, is Revenge of the Revenge of the Jedi?
It's Return of the Jedi. But like the Jedi returns in the first like 5 minutes. So there's a little bit of tension when it's just like C-3PO at Jabba's palace is like, is he going to be able to do this by himself? And this like, no, yeah, the Jedi has returned, and he comes.
The Jedi returned.
So that's not much, it doesn't spoil much there.
He returned. Well, arguably the Jedi returned at the end when Darth Vader becomes a Force ghost.
Sure. I hadn't really thought about that, but that is actually that's probably an intended, cool, subtle meaning of this. We've gotten a little off track here.
Barely.
Just slightly. So, on the theme of,
oh,
food, peanuts. I don't know. I can't make a connection.
Well, peanuts are a food.
As are some of the things that I mention in this fact. Fun fact.
Yeah.
On Mount Everest, vegetables will not cook in a pot of boiling water.
Is that because the water won't boil?
No, it will boil.
But the vegetables won't cook. They'll just sit in there, not getting any cooked.
Crunchy as heck.
Wow.
As long as you cook them. Or as long as you boil them.
As long as you boil them. You're trying to boil them, and it's like, water can boil, but not...
It's boiling, but...
But not getting any cooked-er.
They're not getting cooked. So that raises the question.
The question is, what does cooked mean?
What does cooked mean? What does it mean to cook a vegetable? Well, basically, it means softening it. I mean, there's different methods of cooking, but what I'm talking about when I say cook in this context is softening it by breaking down the pectin, fibers, and starches in the vegetables, so how they get softer, more delicious, easier to digest. And that happens at a temperature starting around 183 Fahrenheit.
Hey, look at you.
Look at those.
Using the one true.
The at least in Canada, the cooking books and recipes typically do temperatures in Fahrenheit. So that's my
your country is the most ridiculous.
We're like 80% metric. and also the majority of our audience is American. So the vegetable starches and things start breaking down at 183 Fahrenheit, but at the peak of Everest, water boils at 154.
Okay.
Which is only 68 degrees Celsius. Like, that's, like, not that much higher than, like, the hottest day in Death Valley. Because the air pressure is, like, a third of what it is here.
It's here. Yeah. So, but when water boils... So you can cook vegetables at Everest. You just have to heat the water past boiling.
I mean...
Can you heat water past boiling?
You just have to heat the water past boiling. But, like, what is... What do you have then?
Yeah, that's my question. Can you heat water?
You have steam. You can. But once it reaches, like, that's like kind of the definition.
It starts to evaporate.
Boiling. No, well, so evaporation is when water is sub-boiling and just the basic, like, kinetic energy causes some percentage of it to disperse into the air. But boiling is when it reaches a point where it no longer exists as a liquid form and becomes a gas. And it goes straight to a gas so at that temperature. And so there is no such thing at sea level as liquid water that's more than 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
And as you get higher and higher up in altitude...
It just lowers what that number is.
It lowers what that number where you can't have liquid...
So you can't get any hotter.
It can't get any hotter before it becomes... A gas.
And yeah, you don't have any liquid anymore. So now you're steam cooking your vegetables.
Right. And so, but like, of course, the steam just disperses into the air, especially on the top of Mount Everest.
Yeah.
We really
so you can't
easily
cook
do that.
Vegetables.
So you can't cook the vegetables. And that kind of raises a little bit of question of like, well, why is that? Like, why is it that the less air, the higher altitude, the less air pressure, why does that make it so that it boils at a lower temperature? And that's because the boiling happens when the pressure of what they call the vapor pressure, which is the pressure at a given heat, as the heat of a given pot of water goes up, the quote-unquote vapor pressure of that liquid goes up, which is the pressure it's exerting upward trying to basically escape as a gas. But then to counteract that, you have the air pressure pushing down on it, holding
the
it
air
in.
Air is less heavy. It's less heavy at the top of Mount
Everest. But at the top of Mount Everest, there isn't as much. There's actually a third of as much ambient pressure holding that water in.
So it just gets out really quickly
and
at
so
a lower
agitating
temperature.
It with heat. Yeah, it's more easily escapes off into the surrounding
air
as a gas. And so that's like this effect. And so that causes problems. And it's not just vegetables. Like if you wanted to have like pasta. If you tried to cook pasta, it wouldn't soften.
I only try to cook pasta. Does that change anything?
Pasta and pasta are have similar cooking
techniques.
And this is actually enough of an issue. Like, so obviously Everest is an extreme, peak of Everest is an extreme case, but in mountainous cities, like in La Paz, Bolivia, which is like the city with the highest elevation, depending on how you define a city, water boils at a hotter temperature, but still 190 instead of 212, which is still enough. Like, that's just barely enough that vegetables will eventually cook, but it takes, like, a really long time. And so this effect of the fact that water has a limit of how hot it can get before it comes to a gas is actually the cause of a different phenomenon, which is, why can't you brown a steak in boiling water?
Yeah.
It's not because the water is too wet and that, like, browning a steak requires dryness, because, like, if there's oil, then it can brown. It's because the browning reaction happens in around 300 degrees Fahrenheit.
And you can't get that
and
hot.
The water can't get hot enough. And so you just get this blah gray steak that doesn't have that. They call it the Maillard reaction. That is called the browning.
Yeah. So what do they do?
Because the water can't get hot.
To eat vegetables, then? Do they just eat them raw?
No. Well, they probably do that. But no, they use pressure cookers. So pressure cookers are a thing that are around. Everyone has, you know, pressure cookers available, the Instant Pot. But if you go to a mountainous place like Colombia or even like in Colorado, pressure cookers are more popular because they're faster. So a pressure cooker cooks things at roughly like twice the air pressure that we have in the ambient. So it allows you to get that water up to 250 Fahrenheit.
Oh.
Which... At sea level is like, oh yeah, that's improvement. It'll speed things up. It'll cook faster. But when you're on the mountain, the difference from like 190 to 250 is bigger. And if you're on the Mount Everest, then that's an even bigger difference.
If you want to boil something. Hike up Mount Everest with a pressure cooker.
My guess is that they're probably not going to the peak with it.
No,
with an Instant Pot strapped to their back. So.
That doesn't seem smart.
But maybe a base camp?
Although these days, I feel like, you know, Mount Everest is not what it used to be.
No.
Yeah.
There's maybe been someone who's brought it. Maybe that's like a
Guinness record.
You get that sponsored as
like
a stunt.
How many? Maybe someone brought like six of them because you needed to like...
Instant Pops? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, the next time I go to La Paz, I'll bring my pressure cooker.
There'll probably be one there. My guess is you could do an Airbnb in La Paz, they'll have a pressure cooker.
They'll have a pressure cooker. Yeah.
Because like it takes forever for vegetables to boil because they're like very just slightly over the
temperature. Yeah, yeah.
They boil, but they don't cook.
Super interesting. Well, that's what's so fascinating is the idea that I put the vegetables in the boiling water. It's boiling. The vegetables are in there, but they're not cooking. If I took them out, they'd be warm, but not.
They'd be hot,
yeah.
But they'd still be hard. Like you would cool down, and they would crack. The carrot would still crunch.
Yeah,
just as much.
That's crazy. That's cool.
As if it had been sitting in water. So of course, this all leads up to the obvious burning question.
Burning
is
like cooking.
Could you build a pressure cooker that could get hot enough to brown a steak?
I don't care about browning steaks, so that did not occur to me. But now that you say so, yeah, could you?
Yeah, you just have to get about 70 PSI, which is 4 or 5 times more pressure
that's
than a typical
that
pressure
crazy.
Cooker. But that's only like that's only as much pressure as a champagne cork.
That's the amount of pressure that's in my CO2 line for my water.
Right. So it should be feasible to build a pressure cooker that holds enough pressure that you could brown meat, like get or any other sort of that Maillard reaction where you get kind of the browning caramelization stuff going on. You could get that in a pressure cooker. You just got to make it 5 times higher pressure than a typical pressure cooker, which would, you know, perhaps present some risks if it were to go wrong. But
well, but you don't if you did that in La Paz, it's only like 2 times higher or whatever. 3 times?
It would be more dangerous in La Paz because the difference in between.
Oh, wait, you're right. You got to go the other way.
Air
if you went
inside
to,
the pressure cooker would be worse.
If you went under, if you went into like a deep cave.
Yes, yeah. Actually, yeah, that's something that I hadn't really like looked into at all, but like presumably at some depth, like if you made a pit in the ground at some depth, you would get to a noticeably increased air pressure.
Yeah.
And so you could boil water at a higher temperature than 100 Celsius, higher than 212 Fahrenheit, and then you could cook things a little bit faster. And so maybe that's your way
browning my meat there.
We have to then figure out how deep of a pit do you need
you
to build.
You do brown a lot of steaks? Is that...
No, it's just nice to get just a little bit of...
Do you cook a lot of steaks?
I would more say chicken. You want a little bit of brown.
Oh,
like,
okay.
If you just cook chicken and then there's too much liquid in the pan, like if you put in onions and you put chicken right
away...
Yeah.
It browns it.
Then it doesn't get hot enough because of the water evaporating cools things down, right? And so you don't get a little, you want just a little bit of brown. I don't like it like charred.
Yeah.
But just like a little bit of browning on some of those foods. And the onions too, you know.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't like a little browning of their onions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that business idea there of the browning pressure cooker available, we'll take a modest you know,
100%
of the profits. 100%. Nah, I mean, I say let's give do 80-20. Like, we'll only take 80%.
Yeah, you get 20%. You just do all the other work.
Yeah, the engineering.
Deal. Yeah.
Definitely, though, the liability, I would say that would be.
Oh, that's on the 20% side. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in agreement on that one. Well, for you, my special friend, I have a food-related fact.
Nice. Yeah. All right. We got a theme going.
Sort of.
Peanuts, vegetables.
Sort of. Okay. So, fun fact. We didn't always say cheese when taking a photo.
Mm.
We used to say prunes instead.
No.
Yeah. So.
Doesn't achieve. Like, there's lots of things you can say instead of cheese. Anything has an E sound in it, you show your teeth.
No, you're 100% right.
Prunes.
Yeah, it doesn't do that.
You'd be making like a.
You know what?
Face.
People didn't use to smile in photos, Alan.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, as you point out, the reason we say cheese when taking a photo is because people want their subjects in their photo to be smiling with their lips apart and their teeth showing. And cheese, if you say it in a big way, especially if you're a child, saying cheese makes you do that. But in the 19th century, nobody smiled in photos. And I always thought, and maybe you always thought, that was because, well, why do you think that was? Why did people not smile?
I was told it was because you couldn't hold a genuine smile.
Right.
For
that
long
is
for
what
it,
I thought too. But that is not the whole story. So,
because there definitely was like some of the early photo processes, it would be like a literal full minute on like silver nitrate.
No,
or
8 hours or something. But
yeah, sure.
But so that is not the reason. And I say that because people only really started smiling in like most photos, like say like a yearbook photo, post World War II.
Okay.
Long after cameras could correctly capture an instant in an instant. And at least one historian, I will link the article, Christina Kuchmadova, argues that people were mainly following cultural and behavioral expectations. It wasn't a technology issue. And that etiquette codes of that era, as she said, etiquette codes of the past demanded that the mouth be carefully controlled. Beauty standards likewise called for a small mouth. Big smiles were considered silly, childish, or downright wicked. In the fine arts, a grin was only characteristic of peasants, drunkards, children, and halfwits, suggesting low class or some other deficiency. So at least one British photographer, starting in the 1840s, told his subject to say prunes because that helps you keep your mouth prim and proper.
And it's interesting you think about that. If I think of like paintings, right? Like before photos.
Yeah.
But you think of like a painting from the 1700s or the
1400s
or even Great Pens or whatever. Yeah, I don't think of them.
They're not smiling.
Smile.
So why?
They're looking epic.
Where did smiling come from?
Yeah, what's the deal with that?
According to the same researcher, by around the turn of the century, 1900s, photography had become affordable for most people, but people still took it very formally, still like a very serious business. And the Eastman Kodak Company, who basically had a monopoly on the camera business, wanted to boost sales of cameras to middle-class buyers by making photography seem fun. So Kodak started a series of active marketing campaigns to emphasize the pleasure of photography. They sent professionals to families during the holidays in particular so they could try to establish a connection between the idea that a celebration required photography. And they started putting out all these marketing campaigns saying like the fun of photography and embrace the fun of it all and all this stuff. So basically, like so much of modern American and Canadian life, what we do now is the victim of corporations wanting to get more of your money. So much like many holidays we celebrate, which are just shills by the greeting card companies, the smiling photography, which to be clear, I'm totally okay with. I think this one, we kind of all did okay on the capitalism. But this was all originally just a ploy to sell more cameras.
I guess there's also probably an effect here, which is like related to the capitalism piece of it, which is that as photography becomes less precious, like as it becomes more accessible to more, you can more easily just take quick snaps and family and you're doing it for fun as opposed to for your official portrait as the CEO of a thing or whatever, you know, some of the early photography, it was like, there's like some ridiculously early photos from like the 1800s of like the emperor of Japan or whatever. Or they like, and then it's like, oh, this was, and you see like what year this image was captured. And you're like, really? They had this kind of,
we're immortalizing you in photography.
Yeah. But it was like very expensive and challenging and whatever to capture this image. And then as it becomes more and more and more accessible, obviously to the extreme now that we have, everybody has.
Right. But that had to be, that idea had to be sold.
Mm-hmm.
Like this was a product. It was like, oh, you can afford to be part of this. And it's much easier, I think, to sell things based on the idea that it's happy and fun and your kids are smiling, your family's smiling, that idea of a smiling family, than it is like a dour, serious portrait.
Here's a question that you may or may not know the answer to. It's like in some cultures, it's considered a little unusual to smile at strangers the way that you might in like Canada or America. Is smiling in a photo like less common in those cultures?
It's very funny that you asked that, Alan, because while I don't know that exact answer, I will tell you that everything I've told you so far about cheese and prunes, that's just English.
Sure.
So what do they do in other languages? And I've noticed for many years now that my wife's German family, they don't usually say cheese sometimes, but not usually. What they usually say is spaghetti.
Okay.
Which accomplishes the same goal.
Yeah, it still gets the E for the smile. Yeah.
So I started wondering, what do other cultures around the world do, to your point? And
do we have a list?
Of course, there's an awesome Wikipedia list for this topic, because Of course there is. And it turns out that many other languages have adopted this method. Often they literally say cheese. Would you like me to send you the list?
No, I've found
you got it. Yeah, it's the Say Cheese Wikipedia article. But they don't all say cheese. In Argentina, they say whiskey. Whiskey.
Okay.
In China, they say a word that means eggplant, but apparently sounds like cheese. In France and other French-speaking countries, they say ouistiti. I don't know if I'm probably not pronouncing that quite right.
It's a French word for marmoset.
Yeah. Apparently. In Hungary, they say there flies the little bird in Hungarian. Hmm. In India, they say paneer, which of course is cheese.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But also has the E sound.
In Israel, they say tagidu cheese, say cheese. They literally just translate say cheese to say cheese. But in Japan, they say chizu.
Okay.
So they're saying cheese. Korea says kimchi, which is amazingly on brand.
Yeah.
But this list is places from all over the world. A lot of places say something about being little birds, which I find odd and interesting. Like, I guess maybe there used to be those birds on the top of the camera or something. Spain says something about a bird. Serbia says something about a bird. In Turkey, they say the word for cheese in Turkish, which is peynir. I think anytime the word cheese also has that E sounded in your local language, you just use that because it's easier. Estonians say pea soup.
I don't see. I mean, well, the Estonian word for pea soup. So that
right.
makes
any herne soup. I don't know how you say it. They're all sort of that same E sound, but that's from pretty much all over the world. Like, I don't know. Vietnam, they do it. I mean, so I see Southeast Asia, East Asia, West Asia, Europe. I don't see any African countries listed here. North African, but not sub-Saharan. So I don't know what's going on there. But a lot of the world, South America, certainly, a lot of the world seems to be doing this.
Okay. Yeah. Or at least like they have a phrase to try and instigate that. But it may be more or less common if you're taking a photo to encourage your
folks. Oh, Nigeria. To smile. Cheese. Yeah, you could
like
be
the
right.
The presence of a term may
you,
or may
you
not.
Could be right. You could be right. Say
like someone
raisins.
Was saying in like Japan, it's like to go in somewhere and just like smile at the folks in the street.
Yeah, but I think when you see like if you picture a Japanese like street photo, you know, you do picture sort of the peace sign right in the smiling.
Yeah, or maybe they would like make a face of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I do love
also like now I might have like Yeah, there's also like what face would you use for a family photo and what face would you use for like the gram?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. If we're you know, as discussed in the Patreon only pre-show, Alan loves him some social media still. I know it's 2024, you'd think, but no, he still loves it.
I'm trying to make it work.
It cannot work. It does not work.
It's just fundamentally doomed.
Yeah, very much so. You're fundamentally doomed by it.
Well, yeah, because I'm still participating
in
social media.
Yeah, that's right.
Blue sky, it might work.
I mean, the sky is blue.
Sixth times the charm.
That's right. they're federated. You got your federating now. Are you federating, Alan?
I think so. I'll double check.
You're doing some good federating.
I have a little bit of follow-up.
Oh, I love follow-up.
So we recently discussed the North Star.
We did.
Polaris, or it's currently Polaris.
It won't be forever.
But it won't be forever, eventually, due to the wobble of the Earth.
I call it Starry Star.
Movement. The Starry Star.
Yeah.
The North Star will stop being Polaris, and I was saying how it will become Vega.
Yeah.
As the sort of where the top of the Earth points to.
But I won't have to change what I'm saying because I'll just keep saying Starry Star.
You'll just say Starry Star.
Yeah.
Or North Star would probably still work. Except that friend of the show, Lauren Florico, pointed out something, which is that by the time this happens,
yeah,
that we have that movement of the Earth pointing straight up, it may not be the North Star anymore. It may be the South Star.
What?
Because the Earth's magnetic field reverses from time to time, and we're overdue for the next magnetic field reversal of the Earth.
Wait, what?
Yeah, so...
What?
I'd prepared for this as like, well, we all know that the Earth's magnetic field reverses sometimes.
Wait, what?
But like, I didn't think about the fact that that would make the North Star the South Star. But I'm discovering in real time that this is news to Arik.
What is occasionally?
Yeah, so sometimes, every once in a while, you know, every 450,000 years or so.
Okay, and we're overdue.
And we're overdue. It's been 780,000 years.
Since the last time this happened.
Since up became down, north became south.
That would be pretty dramatic.
It would be inconvenient.
What does that mean in practice?
So if you have a compass,
yeah, that part
it would point the other way around.
That's it. Is that the only change?
If you were a bird,
you'd fly the opposite
and maybe a little bit extinct.
Yeah.
Depending.
Is that the only, like, what would be the effects?
I was fairly worried about this when I first heard about it, because I was one of those like, oh great, there's another like Armageddon movie of like the day of the magnetic pole made everything stop working.
It takes 7,000 years for it to happen.
It takes thousands of years for it to actually transition.
Okay.
So what we would see, yeah, and so there's been a bit of a weakening of the magnetic field of the Earth in recent centuries or whatever.
It's not good news for Magneto.
It's not good news for Magneto, or maybe it is good news because his powers wouldn't be relatively more powerful than that. Anyway, so the fact
that
the Earth's
an hour on that
field speculating about impact of magnetism flipping on reversal of the field. Anyway, so there has been a bit of a trend towards weakening, and which is what you would expect
before
when it's
going
to flip. But also, it's also just typical for it to get stronger and weaker over time, and we're still at more field strength than the median over the last million years.
Okay.
So like we're in the normal range right now, and in our lifetimes it won't have flipped. Like it's the amount of time that it takes to change. I don't plan on living for
7,000 years.
But if you were to plan, if you lived for like 5,000 years or 2,000 years, I'm not saying like if you decide to, like it's up to you. I don't want to pass judgment.
But if you did live for
like a few thousand years, there might be like a reduction of the field enough that it gets like unstable or, you know. I can link in the show notes, some of the simulations and like graphics of what it looks like while it's transitioning are wild. Like there's multiple north and south poles.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like I was going to ask because it's like have to be like, multiple north. That would make it very hard for certain things to. There are probably a lot of things that function on that I'm not thinking of.
Yeah, there's I'm 100% sure that there's electronic devices that assume that there's only one each of north and south.
Yeah, totally. Which, you know, don't make assumptions. That's how you mess up.
But it seems like we'll get a little bit of warning, so we'll be able to update the firmware on your navigation units and the like to firmware might not be quite enough, but you know we'll be able to adapt in time.
Yeah, what's the effect going to be on the Apple Watch? You know, I think that's what you need to know.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to make sure that you're forward compatible, right?
Yeah,
people don't even support Y2038 yet, so I right. feel like yeah. supporting the reversal of the magnetic field of the Earth in tens of thousands of years is probably
people don't even support everyone's address, right? Or like, you know, every zip code or whatever. So like, you know,
yeah.
Okay, well, I'll see you in 7,000 years to see what happened.
So we'll do a follow-up yeah. When the North Star, but the star on the side of the Earth that the Arctic is near.
Yeah.
We'll do a follow-up whether or not that's still north or if that's become south in the meanwhile.
Yeah. If any time travelers want to come and tell us about it, we'll have you on the show.
Then go to Fun Fact FM. You can leave us feedback and give us stock tips.
I mean, I want to know about the fate of the Earth. Alan just wants to make a book.
I mean, the fate of the Earth is important. Like, I would just say, like, make sure you prioritize that for the show, yeah. and then, you know, stock tapes optionally.